Thank you to your organizers for allowing me to share a little bit of what we do in the bean breeding community. It's one of my passions. I mean, I've been working on beans for probably 15 years of my professional career, so it's a really exciting thing. Just to emphasize some of the points that BB just did, I always show this graph to people in my talks because it shows the big gap that exists between cereals and pulses worldwide. And I'm not expecting that we're going to get to the same level as cereals because we're machines. We need energy, and of course the starchy crops provide that. That's not a problem. But I would like to see that gap being reduced. I think we also need the protein in our lives, and that will solve a lot of the health issues that we're seeing. Another interesting graph is this one that shows kind of the distribution of where pulses and cereals are being grown worldwide. And then, so in the dotted red, you have rain-fed, low-input areas. In the dash red, you have the rain-fed, high-input. And then in the irrigated is the whitish areas. And as you can see, there are startling differences regarding the decision of where I grow my cereals versus where I grow my pulses, right? Where we see that pretty much the marginal land, the low input radius, is where people would put their pulses in the developing world. That's the DW there. Then you have the developing world or developed world or rest of world, and you see a little bit more of a balance there. But you know, overall, we can say that pulses always get punished by being on marginal land versus cereals. And that's another, you know, people come and you hear a lot of people saying all the time, yeah, why in pulses we are not getting the same gains as we see in cereals? Well, here is one of the reasons why, even after all the efforts that we do and with the less amount of resources that we have, right? Not everything is bad. This is a meeting called, you know, that it's going around resilience. And I can show you this graph that it talks, shows the water footprint of different foods that we eat normally. As you can see, pulses is one of the foods that have less water footprint in all the things that we produce worldwide. Really interesting to see that graph there. Let's talk about beans. Bean basics, for those of you who don't know much about beans. Beans is probably one of the few crops that have one center of origin, but two multiple centers of domestication. And that's what the map is showing here. You have a center of origin, central South Mexico. That's been the most precise origin based on some molecular data recently. And then we have two groups that pretty much are known as the gene pools, right? So we have the Mesoamerican gene pool, the Andean gene pool, and within each one of them, we have something what we call races. And those are very important for us to be able to be organized in the work that we do. Claire was saying, I work with 7 market classes, and they are spread all over all these different races and groups. So it makes my life miserable, you know, trying to keep up all these things separate, but at the same time, it's really fun to have all this diversity that I have to deal with. So you probably recognize some classes that are important. Here are the Pintos, here are the Gray Northerns, you have the Navies, the Blacks, the Reds, here are the Kidneys, etc., etc. Oh, here they are. So these are the market classes I work with in the U.S. Not only that, it's not only the diversity of classes that you work with, and they're all with the same general species. I mean, they're all Phaseolus vulgaris. I can make crosses with any of those. But it's also the diversity of production systems that we get to see worldwide. Climbing beans, bush types, determinate types. I mean, I've seen so many variations. I have a breeding program funded by USAID in Guatemala in which you have intercropping of corn and beans in the same piece of land, which makes everything even more complicated because now we're talking about a whole cropping system. BB kind of alluded to these, but this is a graph that shows the importance of dry beans worldwide compared to all the other pulses. I'm not trying to be bashful or anything like that. Just show that, you know, 40% of the war area or 40% of our production worldwide on pulses is pretty much dry beans. There is one big pulse that is missing there in that graph. I didn't do that graph, by the way. Anybody see it? Peas. Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. Yeah. The other thing that happens with dry beans is that you have to be careful with the statistics from FAO. FAO is a little bit misleading because what they call dry beans is actually two species. They lump together Phaseolus and Vigna, which makes a lot of sense because it wasn't until the 1950s that the taxonomists decided to say these are two separate things. But FAO stats are still 50 years old because they haven't changed that. So I don't know who to talk to kind of split that. But if you, so these two people, Akidobi and Maridia from Michigan State University, that's probably the best attempt I've seen to filter out the true Phaseolus data, you know, separated from Vigna. And that's where you realize that Brazil, Mexico, and Tanzania are the largest world producers of dry beans, and followed by Uganda, Kenya, and then U.S. It's the sixth largest producer. When it comes to USA, the state that I work in, it's the largest producer, as someone already mentioned, followed by Michigan, Nebraska, Idaho, and Minnesota, which, if you remember the U.S. map, these are the two neighbor states, so pretty much 40-50% of the total U.S. production comes from the region I work with. Production problems, many, right? That's one of the issues in pulses. BB already mentioned all the issues with diseases. Pests, especially in the tropics, big time. Tropics have even more disease problems and more production problems than what we have in the temperate zones. You have some other abiotic stresses that are always there. You know, the list goes on. We cannot probably go into mentioning each one of these things, but I'll try to show you some of the things that probably are good examples of things that have been working and are helping to solve problems, right? This is a survey we do in my state every year, asking the growers, okay, which one is your worst problem in your fields? And as you can see from last year, my main problem is flooding, too much water, too much rain, right? May 2015 was the wettest month since record keeping in North Dakota in 1889. So whoever thinks that global warming is not happening, you know, you can show them this graph here. And then you have diseases and many other things that the growers are battling with. There are good news, Todd. I mean, these are all things that have contributed to increased yields, either directly or indirectly, in beans. We have disease-resistant cultivars. I know BB wasn't too hopeful, but we have good cases of disease resistance for these problems that we have here, bean common mosaic, bean gold and yellow mosaic virus in Central America, rust and tracknose, CBB. We have some advances in drought tolerance genotypes. In the U.S., changes in plant architecture have changed the whole way in which we do dry bean production. Improved agronomic performance, better chemicals, improved plant densities, and of course, all this new era of genomics that is helping us to understand a lot of things. The bean genome sequence was released in 2014, and I've seen a slush of just articles and manuscripts trying to use this data. The picture in the U.S. is actually not too bad. When you look at the yield gains across years, this is from 1910 to 2012. It's a book chapter that we did for Crop Science. We actually presented this data 2 years ago in Tampa, right, Mark? Yeah. So if you're interested, I can show you that publication. It's really good. But pretty much 12.9, 13 kilograms per hectare per year that we can report on gains or yield gains for dry beans in the U.S., okay? So, again, people say, why not getting yield gains in beans? Yes, we do. Look at, and this is on-farm data. This is what the farmers are getting. This is not my trials or things like that. Now, when you look at what happens in the U.S. versus the developing countries, then the story is quite interesting and quite concerning. This is a picture showing the yield gap for just pinto seeds in the U.S., pinto beans. And in red you have what is the potential yield, so what the beans should be yielding in optimal conditions, and in blue is actually what farmers are getting. So 20% yield gap between the theoretical yield versus the real yield. When you look at other places like Latin America or Africa, look at the yield gaps. These people are losing 50 or 60% of their crop to different problems and different things, right? Here's probably a better way to see the same issue. You have developing world, this is yield in tons per hectare, rest of the world or developed world, and then the world together. But look at the huge gap between developing countries and modern countries of modernized agriculture, right? Something has to be done there. That's where the issue really is. I'm going to show you a good example of a successful story in the U.S., and then I'm going to show you another example in the tropics that I think those serve as good examples that things can be done. It's been well known that there has been major plant architectural changes in other crops. We have examples of lodging improvement in wheat and rice, and that led to a lot of improvements in productivity, right? Same thing in sorghum and corn with the leaf angle that allowed to increase population densities in corn, for example. So we wanted to take the same approach and try to understand how we can use the same idea to kind of have a more efficient harvest for the beans, mechanized harvest in the U.S. Before, it was a two-step operation. You had to cut the beans, then combine later on two pieces of equipment and everything. Now everybody is just using direct combining or direct harvest, and it's working really well. And that's because breeders were able to breed for upright architecture. This is the old style beans that were grown probably in the 60s and 70s and 80s. Now in the 90s and 2000s, this is what you're going to see in bean fields. Huge change, and the impact is so dramatic that in the same survey that I was telling you about, we asked the growers, okay, how much of your land, how much of your dry bean acreage you are doing direct combining versus conventional? And you can see by year, the blue bar, which is 0 to 50%, is going down, and more people are increasing the direct harvest operation just because they have better varieties to do that. So it's not necessarily yield, but it's convenience, it's efficiency, it's the whole operation. Let me show you another example in the tropics, so we're not skewed. You're showing successful stories in the temperate zone. This is probably one of the most important diseases in Latin America and Central America and the Caribbean. It's a virus, and in Brazil, number one problem. Two, they have another strain, similar strain. Pretty much anything that is today available as a variety in Central America and the Caribbean has this gene called BGM1 and confers resistance to this thing. So now, places that in which you pretty much couldn't grow beans anymore because of the bean golden yellow mosaic pressure, you now have decent productions that allow you at least to have something, not only for your family, but to sell as well. Another interesting story, probably more recent, is the development of resistance to seed borers, brookids. Big problem post-harvest. You harvest your beans, you put them in a storage, and a few weeks later, this is what you're going to have after that. There is a new gene known as the APA locus. It's actually three genes together, and it's allowing now to have resistant lines that are solving this problem. So now these insects are pretty much dying, starving, because they cannot get into eating those beans. Imagine the impact of those things in cultivars later on. I think this is the future of pulses. It's looking beyond the regular plate of pulses or your bean stew or whatever you want to call it. It's looking at what we can do to use beans as a product or as an atom product. Look at the amount of products that we have today that use some sort of pulse ingredient versus what happened 10 years ago. There is a huge explosion, and the industry is highly interested in this. And so we as a scientific community have to figure out how we're going to contribute to this. This is big. I was in Portugal two weeks ago in the International Legume Society Conference. Someone was talking about bean beer in the UK. Bean beer. So I was, I mean, just tell me where to buy it and I'll go and buy it, yeah. New phenomics, high throughput phenomics, things that we're doing in order to understand better what's going on inside the plants, how we can improve some of these things. We're working with Michigan State University. Team Porch in Mayagüez is using this car to collect a lot of data about his genotypes and use that for selection purposes as well, mostly for heat tolerance. Phil Miklas and some collaborators at USDA Washington is using drones to take pictures of his drought trials and figure out differences among genotypes. So, I mean, there is all this revolution of new technology that hopefully we can use for that. The last thing I want to show you, and I think that's something that concerns us as a community, as a Pulse community, is we have to take advantage of this much more. Legumes have a lot in common, more than what we think really they have. This is just an example in my tribe, which is called the Faciolae tribe, but you have pretty much Medicago here, Cajanus, Fasciolae beans, and then soybeans, right? This chart down here is showing you the amount of time. So these are the eight chromosomes of Medicago, and it's showing you each one of those colors represent the times that the same gene for disease resistance, NBS LLRs, were also found in these other species. So there is a lot of cross-combining there that we can use. For example, we use a lot of the soybean resources because, of course, they have done a lot of things that are interesting for us. And we see a lot of synteny blocks, places that are conserved across both species, and allow us to, we don't have time to probably explain all this chart here, but all this showing is that we have all these conserved genomic regions between all these legumes that we need to exploit much better. And it works both ways. Things that we find, for example, in dry beans, for every gene that we found of interest, we found two copies in soybeans. Because soybean is pretty much a whole genome duplication event of dry beans, right? Pretty interesting stuff. We're working with waterlog intolerance. My postdoc, Ali Soltani, is here. He was able to find, for example, genes in soybean that are related to root weight and germination rate. And we're able to map those back and forth between soybean and dry bean. Really interesting. And I think I'm done with this one. Future challenges. Global warming. We need to keep working on it. Not only for drought, but also for flooding. New diseases, new strains. I think the human consumption and nutrition aspects are going to keep getting more and more and more importance. There is a first successful stories of biofortified beans in Africa and Central America, stuff that SIAT is being releasing there. I already talked about the bean processing opportunities that I see there. A lot to do in terms of biological nitrogen fixation. People say legumes fix nitrogen, but they're not very efficient as we might think they are. And we need to keep working on it. GMO beans, the first case of GMO beans, it's currently going in Brazil for bean golden mosaic resistance. I've seen the material and it's pretty promising. I'm really curious to see what's going to be the consumer acceptance of all these because we have all this discussion about feed versus food kind of things. Other traits, and I think I'll leave it there. Hope that you enjoyed. Janice told me to say beans are hot. Claire say that we have time for one question. Oh, Janice.
Yeah. How hot are they?
They're very hot because you can grow them in very hot environments.
So
yeah.
There's a legitimate question. So what are you hearing with respect to the GMO trend in beans? Is that something that the research community is actively pursuing and engaged in?
I guess I can answer that from my personal experience. I've been following, trying to follow what's going on in Brazil, because I think it's going to be a reflection of what's going to happen later on in the U.S. There was a whole new law in Brazil to label any product that has GMO products on it, right? Any content of GMO crops. And people were thinking, well, this is going to just shift the entire market. People are going to stop buying these things and everything. Nothing happened. People are buying the same product, the same stuff, even with the labeling. So that got me thinking, well, maybe this deal about the GMO bean won't be too bad. But again, you never know. We're a weird society. You never know what's going to happen. Look at today, for example. Yeah. Thank you.